Blazing suns, cloudy skies overhanging oceans, covered with jagged waves. Leaping animals, figures in flowing robes or filigreed armor, all formed by interlaced knots. As the first plain pictures became entire tapestries of tangled light and shadow, Simon understood that he watched an unfolding story. The ever-growing tapestry of knotted fabric portrayed people who loved and fought in a garden-like land of incredible strangeness, a place where plants and creatures thrived, whose forms seemed obscure, even though precisely rendered by the unknown weaver's masterful magical hands. Then, as the tapestry eloquently showed, something began to go wrong. Only ribbons of white were used, but still Simon could almost see the dark stain that began to spread through the people's lives and hearts the way it sickened them. Brother fought brother, and what had been a place of unmatched beauty was blighted beyond hope. Some of the people began building ships.
"Here," Editu said, startling him.
The tapestry had led them to a whirlpool swirl of pale fabric, an inward-leading spiral that appeared to lead up a gentle hill. On the right, beside this odd door, the tapestry leaped away across the river, trembling in the bright air like a bridge of silk. Where the taut ribbons of the tapestry vaulted the splashing stream, the knots portrayed 8 magnificent ships at sea, cresting woven waves. The tapestry touched the willows on the far side and turned, winding back up the watercourse in the direction from which Simon and Aditu had come, stretching away from tree to tree until it could no longer be seen. Aditu's hand touched his arm, and Simon shivered. Walking in someone else's dream, he had forgotten himself. He followed her through the doorway and up a set of stairs carefully cut into the hillside, then paved with colourful, smooth stones. Like everything else, the corridor through which they walked was made of rippling, translucent cloth. The walls were white near the door, gradually darkening to pale blue and turquoise. In her white clothes, Aditu reflected this shifting light, so that as she walked before him, she too seemed to change colour. Simon trailed his fingers along the wall and found that it was as exquisitely soft as it looked, but curiously strong. It slid beneath his hand as smoothly as gold wire, yet was warm to the touch, as the down of a baby bird, and quivered with the wind's every breath. The featureless corridor soon opened up into a large, high-ceilinged room that, but for the instability of its walls, looked much like a room in any fine house. The turquoise hue of the cloth near the entrance shaded imperceptibly into ultramarine. A low table of dark wood stood near one wall, with cushions scattered all around it. On the table sat a board painted in many colors. Simon thought it a map, until he recognized it as a place to play the game called Shent, which he had seen Jiriki do in his hunting lodge. He remembered Aditu's challenge. The pieces, he guessed, were in the intricate wooden box sitting beside it on the tabletop. The only other item on the table was a stone vase, containing a single branch from a flowering apple tree.
"Sit down, Snorlock, please," Aditu waved her hand. "I believe Jiriki has a visitor."
Before Simon could follow her suggestion, the room's far wall began to billow. A section flew up as if it had torn free. Someone dressed in bright green, whose braided hair was a jarringly contrasting shade of red, stepped through. Simon was surprised at how quickly he recognized Jiriki's uncle, Kendra Jaharo. The Sither was muttering gruffly in what seemed to be fury. Seemed, because Simon could see no discernible emotion on his face at all. Then Kendra Jaharo looked up and spotted Simon. His angular face blanched as though the blood had run out of him, like water from an upended pail.
"Sororaya! Issi Issiya! Sororaya!"
he gasped, his voice full of an anger so astonished as to seem like something else altogether.
Kendra Jaharo dragged his slender, beringed hand slowly across his eyes and face, as if trying to wipe away the sight of gangly Simon. Unable to do so, Chiriki's uncle hissed in almost feline alarm, then turned on Aditu and began to speak to her in rapid, quietly liquid Scythi, that nonetheless strengthened the suggestion of spitting rage. Aditu absorbed his tirade expressionlessly, her deep gold-shot eyes wide but unfrightened. When Kendra Jaharo had finished, she answered him calmly. Her uncle turned and regarded Simon once more, making a series of strangely sinuous gestures with his splayed fingers, as he listened to her measured response. Kendra Jaharo took a deep breath, letting a preternatural calm overtake him, until he stood motionless as a pillar of stone. Only his bright eyes seemed alive, burning in his face like lamps. After several moments of this overwhelming stillness, he walked from the room without a word or sideways glance, padding silently down the corridor to the door of Jariki's house. Simon was shaken by the unmistakable force of Kendra Jaharo's anger.
"You said something about breaking rules?" he asked.
Aditu smiled strangely.
"Courage, Snowlock. You are Hikastaja."
She brushed her fingers through her hair, a curiously human gesture, then pointed to the flap where her uncle had entered.
"Let us go in to my brother."
They stepped through into sunlight. This room, too, was made of fluttering cloth, but the fabric of one long wall had been rolled and drawn up to the ceiling. Beyond this opening, the hill dropped away for some dozen paces. Below lay a shallow, peaceful backwater of the same river that passed before Jiriki's front door, a wide pond with a narrow inlet neck surrounded by reeds and quivering aspens. Little red and brown birds hopped about on the rocks at the center of the pond, like conquerors strutting the battlements of a captured stronghold. At pond's edge, a bale of turtles basked in the sun, streaming down through the trees.
"In the evening, the crickets are quite splendid here."
Simon turned to see Jiriki, who had apparently been standing in the shadows at the opposite end of the room.
"Welcome to Zhao e Tonukai, Sioman," he said. "We are well met."
"Jiriki!"
Simon sprang forward. Without thinking, he grasped the slender scyther in a tight embrace. The prince tensed for a moment, then relaxed. His firm hand patted Simon's back.
"You never said farewell," Simon said,
then pulled away, embarrassed.
"I did not,"
Jiriki agreed. He wore a long, loose robe of some thin blue cloth, belted at the waist with a wide red band. His feet were bare. His lavender hair descended in braids before either ear, and was gathered atop his head with a comb of pale, polished wood.
"I would have died in the woods if you had not helped me," Simon said abruptly, then gave an awkward laugh. "If Aditu had not come, that is."
He turned to look at her. Jiriki's sister was watching intently. She nodded her head in acknowledgement.
"I would have died."
He realized as he spoke that it was absolutely true. He had begun the process of dying when Aditu had found him, growing more distant each day from the business of life.
"So."
Jiriki folded his arms before him.
"I am honored I could help. It still does not discharge my obligation, however. I owed you two lives. You are my Hikastaja, Sioman, and so you will remain."
He looked over to his sister.
"The butterflies have gathered."
Aditu replied in their lyric tongue, but Jiriki held up his hand.
"Speak in a way that Sioman can understand. He is my guest."
She stared at him for a moment.
"We met Kendra Jaharo. He is not happy." "Uncle has not been happy since Aswa fell. No plans of mine are likely to change that.
It is more than that, Willow Switch, and you know it.
Aditu stared hard at him, but her face remained dispassionate. She turned to look briefly at Simon. For a moment, embarrassment seemed to darken her cheeks.
It is strange to speak this tongue. These are strange days, Rabbit, and you know that.
Jariki lifted his hands toward the sunlight.
Ah, what an afternoon. We must go now, all of us. The butterflies have gathered, as I said. I speak lightly of Kendra Jaharo, but my heart is uneasy.
Simon stared at him, completely baffled.
First allow me to take off this ridiculous clothing,
Aditu said. She slipped away through another hidden door so quickly that she seemed to melt into shadow. Jariki led Simon toward the front of his house.
We will wait for her below. You and I have much to speak about, Seoman. But first, we must go to the Yasira.
Why did she call you Willow Switch?
Of all his countless questions, this was the only one he could put into words.
Why do I call you Snowlock?
Jariki looked closely at Simon's face, then smiled his charming feral smile.
It is good to see you well, man child.
Let us be off,
Aditu said. She had come up behind Simon so soundlessly that he gasped in surprise. When he turned a moment later, he gasped again. Aditu had shed her heavy snow clothing for a dress that was little more than a wisp of glimmering, nearly transparent white cloth, belted with a ribbon of sunset orange. Her slim hips and small breasts were clearly silhouetted beneath the loose garment. Simon felt his face grow hot. He had grown up with the chambermaids, but they had moved him out many years before, sending him to sleep with the other scullions. Such near nakedness was more than disconcerting. He realized he was staring and turned hurriedly away, his face coloring. One hand made an involuntary tree before his chest. Aditu's laugh was like rain.
I am happy to be shed of all that. It was cold where the man-child was, Jariki. Cold. You are right, Aditu,
Jariki said grimly.
We find the winter outside easy to forget when it is still summer in our home. Now, it is off to the Yasira, where some do not want to believe that winter exists at all.
He led the way out his strange entry hall to the sun-splashed corridor of willows beside the river. Aditu followed him. Simon brought up the rear, still blushing furiously, with no choice but to watch her springy, swaying walk. With the added distraction of Aditu and her summer finery, Simon did not think about much of anything for a while. But even Juriki's lissom sister and Zhao Yi Tenokai's myriad other glories could not distract him forever. Several things had been said lately that were beginning to worry him. Kendra Jaharo was angry with him, apparently. And Simon had distinctly heard Aditu say something about breaking rules.
What exactly was happening?
Where are we going, Jariki?
He asked at last.
The Yasira.
The Sither gestured ahead.
There. Do you see?
Simon stared, shielding his eyes from the strong sunlight.
There were so many distractions here, and the sunlight itself was one of the strongest. Only a few days before, he had been wondering if he would ever be warm again. Why was he yet again allowing himself to be dragged somewhere else, when all he wanted to do was flop down on his back in the clover and sleep?
At first, the Yasira seemed like nothing so much as a grand and oddly shaped tent. A tent whose center pole mounted 50 ells into the air.
made of a fabric more shifting and colourful than any of Zhao E Tanukai's other beautiful structures. It took another 24 paces before Simon realized that the centre pole was a gigantic ash tree with wide-spreading branches, whose crown rose into the forest sky high above the Yasira itself. He drew another 100 paces closer, before he saw why the fabric of the vast tent shimmered so. Butterflies. Trailing to the ground from the ash tree's widest branches were 1,000 threads, so slender that they seemed little more than parallel glints of light, as they fell a handspan apart all around the tree. Clinging to these strands from top to bottom, lazily fanning their iridescent wings, huddling so closely that they overlapped each other like the shingles on some impossible roof, were 1,000,000 butterflies. They were of every color imaginable, orange and wine red, oxblood and tangerine, cerulean blue, daffodil yellow, velvet black as the night sky. The quiet whisper of their wings was everywhere, as if the warm summer air itself had been given voice. They moved sluggishly, as though near sleep, but were otherwise bound in no way that Simon could see. Countless chips of vibrant, moving color, the butterflies shattered the sunlight like an incomparable treasury of living gems. In that moment, as Simon first saw it, the Yasira seemed the breathing, glowing center of creation. He stopped and abruptly burst into helpless tears. Juriki did not see Simon's overwhelmed response.
"The little wings are restless," he said. "Suhui Kendraja Aro has brought the word."
Simon sniffled and wiped at his eyes. Faced with the Yasira, he suddenly thought he could understand the bitterness of Inaluki, the Storm King's hatred for childish, destructive mankind. Shamed, Simon listened to Jiriki's words as though from a great distance. The Sither Prince was saying something about his uncle. Was Kendra Jaharo talking to the butterflies? Simon didn't care any longer. This was all just too much for him. He didn't want to think. He wanted to lie down. He wanted to sleep. Jiriki had at last noticed his distress. He took Simon carefully by the elbow and guided him toward the Yasira. At the front of the mad, glorious structure, butterfly-laden strands trailed on either side of a wooden doorway, which was no more than a simple carved frame, wound round with trailing roses. Aditu had already stepped through, and now Jiriki led Simon in. If the effect of the butterflies from outside was one of gleaming magnificence, the view from within was entirely different. The multicolored shafts of light leaked down through the living roof, as if through stained glass that had somehow become unstable. The great ash tree that was the Yasira's spine stood bathed in 1,000 shifting hues. Simon was again reminded of some strange forest thriving beneath the inconstant ocean. This time, however, he was beginning to find the thought a little much to bear. He felt almost as though he were drowning, floundering helplessly in an opulence he could not entirely understand. The great chamber had few furnishings. Beautiful rugs lay scattered everywhere, but in many places the grass grew uncovered. Shallow pools gleamed here and there, flowering bushes and stones around them, all things just as they were outside. The only differences were the butterflies and the Scythi. The chamber was full of Scythi folk, male and female, in costumes as variegated as the wings of the butterflies that quivered overhead. One by one at first, then in clusters, they turned to look at the new arrivals, hundreds of calm, cat-like eyes, agleam in the shifting light. What seemed to Simon a quiet but malicious hiss rose from the multitude. He wanted to run away and actually made a brief stumbling attempt, but Jiriki's grip on his arm was gently unbreakable. He found himself led forward to a rise of earth before the base of the tree. A tall, moss-netted stone stood there, like an admonishing finger sunken in the grassy ground. On low couches before it sat two Scythi, dressed in splendid pale robes, a woman and a man. The man, who was seated closest, looked up at Simon and Jariki's approach. His hair, tied high atop his head, was jet black, and he wore a crown of carved white birchwood. He had the same angular golden features as Jariki, but there was something drawn at the corners of his narrow eyes and thin mouth that suggested a life of great length, filled with vast but subtle disappointment. The woman who sat beside him on his left hand had hair of a deep coppery red. She too wore a circlet of birchwood on her brow. Long white feathers hung from her many braids, and she wore several bracelets and rings as black and shiny as the hair of the man beside her. Of all the Scythi Simon had seen, her face was the most immobile, the most rigidly serene. Both man and woman had an air of age and subtlety and stillness. But it was the quiet of a dark old pond in a shadowed wood, the calm of a sky filled with motionless thunderheads. It seemed entirely possible that such placidity might hide something dangerous. Dangerous to callow mortals, at least.
"You must bow, Sioman," Jariki said quietly.
Simon, as much because of his shaking legs as anything else, lowered himself to his knees. The smell of the warm turf was strong in his nostrils.
"Sioman Snorlock, man-child," Jariki said loudly. "Know you are come before Shimaonari, king of the Zedeia, lord of Zhao E Tnokai, and Lykimea, queen of the Dawn Children, lady of the House of Year Dancing."
Still kneeling, Simon looked up dizzily. All eyes were focused on him, as though he were a singularly inappropriate gift. Shimaonari at last said something to Jariki, words as harsh-sounding as anything Simon had yet heard the Scythi tongue produce.
"No, father," Jariki said. "Whatever else, we must not so lightly turn our backs on our traditions. A guest is a guest. I beg you, speak words that Sioman can understand."
Shimaonari's thin face pinched in a frown. When he spoke at last, he proved far less facile with the westerling tongue than his son and daughter.
"So, you are the man-child that saved Jariki's life?"
He nodded his head slowly, but did not seem very pleased.
"I do not know if you can understand this, but my son has done a very bad thing. He has brought you here against all laws of our people. You, a mortal?"
He straightened up, looking from face to face among the Scythi folk that surrounded them.
"What is done is done. My people, my family," he called. "No harm can come to this man-child. We have not sunk so far. We owe him honor as Hikastaja, as bearer of a white arrow."
He turned back to Simon, and a look of infinite sadness crept over his face.
"But neither can you leave, man-child. We cannot let you leave. So you stay forever. You will grow old and die with us, here in Zhao E Tenokai."
The wings of a million butterflies murmured and whispered.
"Stay?"
Simon turned, uncomprehending, to Jariki. The prince's usually imperturbable face was an ashen mask of shock and sorrow. Simon was silent as they walked back to Jariki's house. Afternoon was slowly fading into twilight. The cooling valley was alive with the smells and sounds of untainted summer. The Scyther did nothing to break the silence, guiding Simon along the tangled paths with nods and gentle touches. As they approached the river that ran past Jiriki's door, Scythi voices lifted in song somewhere in the overhanging hills. The melody that spilled echoing over the valley was an intricately constructed series of descending figures, sweet, but with a touch of dissonance winding through it, like a fox dodging in and out among rainy hedgerows. There was something unquestionably liquid about the song. After a moment, Simon realized that the invisible musicians were in some way singing along with the noise of the river itself. A flute joined in, ruffling the surface of the music like wind on the watercourse. Simon was abruptly and painfully struck by the strangeness of this place. Loneliness welled within him, an aching emptiness that could not be filled by Jiriki or any of his alien kind. For all its beauty, Zhao e Tenokai was no better than a cage. Caged animals, Simon knew, languished and soon died.
"What will I do?" he said hopelessly.
Jiriki stared at the glinting river, smiling sadly.
"Walk, think, learn how to play shent. In Zhao e Tenokai, there are many ways to pass time."
As they walked toward Jiriki's door, the water song cascaded down from the tree-mantled hillside, surrounding them with mournful music that seemed ever-changing, but unhurried, patient as the river itself. Chapter 23. Deep Waters.
"By Elysia, the mother," Aspitus Previs said, "what a terrible time you have had of it, Lady Maria."
The Earl lifted his cup to drink but found it empty. He tapped his fingers on the cloth as his pale squire hurried forward to pour more wine.
"To think that the daughter of a nobleman should be so ill-treated in our city."
The trio sat around the Earl's circular table as the remains of a more than adequate supper were cleared away by a page. Flickering lamplight threw distorted shadows on the walls. Outside, the wind soared in the rigging. Two of the Earl's hounds brawled over a bone beneath the table.
"Your lordship is too kind," Miriam El shook her head. "My father's barony is very small, just a freeholding, really. One of the smallest baronies in Kellachir."
"Ah, then your father must know Godwig?"
Aspitus Westerling was a little difficult to understand, and not only because it was his second tongue. The goblet in his hand had been drained and filled several times.
"Of course, he is the most powerful of all the barons there, the king's strong hand in Kellachir."
Thinking of the despicable braying Godwig, Miriam El found it hard to keep her expression pleasant, even while looking on the goldenly handsome Aspitus. She darted a glance at Cadrach, who was sunk in some dark mood, his brow furrowed like a thunderhead.
"He thinks I'm saying too much,"
Miriam El decided. She felt a flash of anger.
"But who is he to make faces? He got us into this trap. Now, thanks to me, instead of us going over the side as kilpa food, we're at the master's table drinking wine and eating good Lakeland cheese."
"But I am still astonished by your ill fortune, lady,"
Aspitus said.
"I had heard that these fire dancers were a problem in the provinces, and I have seen a few heretical madmen preaching the fire dancer creed in Naban's public places. But the idea that they would actually dare to lay hands on a noblewoman."
"An Erkinlandish noblewoman. A very unimportant one," Miriam El said hastily, worried she might have gone too far in her improvisation. "And I was dressed to travel to my new convent home. They had no idea of my position."
"That is immaterial."
Aspitus waved his hand airily, almost knocking over the candle on the tabletop with his trailing sleeve. He had shed the finery he wore on the quarterdeck, choosing instead a long simple robe, like those worn by knights during their vigil. But for a delicate gold tree on a chain about his neck, his only adornment was the insignia of the Praven House, woven on each sleeve. The osprey wings wrapped his forearms like climbing flames. Miriamel was favorably impressed that a wealthy young man like Aspytis would greet guests in such modest attire.
"Immaterial," he repeated. "These people are heretics and worse. Besides, a noblewoman from Erkinland is no different than one of Naban's own 50 families. Noble blood is the same throughout Ostenard, and like a spring of sweet water in an arid wilderness, must be protected at all costs."
He leaned forward and gently touched her arm through her sleeve.
"Had I been there, Lady Maria, I would have given my life before letting one of them mishandle you."
He leaned back and patted the hilt of his scabbarded sword, studiedly casual.
"But if I had been forced to make that ultimate sacrifice, I would have insisted that a few of them accompany me."
"Oh," said Miriamel. "Oh." She took a deep breath, a little overwhelmed. "But really, Earl Aspytis, there is no need to worry. We escaped quite safely. It's just that we had to flee to your boat and hide. It was dark, you see, and Father Cadrach—"
"Brother," the monk said sourly from across the table. He took a draught of wine.
"Brother Cadrach said that this would be the safest place. So we hid ourselves in the cargo hold. We are sorry for the imposition, Earl, and we thank you for your kindness. If you will only put us ashore at the next port—"
"Leave you out among the islands somewhere? Nonsense!"
Aspytis leaned forward, fixing her with his brown eyes. He had a dangerous smile, Miriamel realized, but it did not frighten her as much as she knew it should.
"You will ride out the voyage with us. Then we may put you safe back in Naban, where you belong. It will be little more than a fortnight, lady. We will treat you well, both you and your guardian."
He briefly turned his smile on Cadrach, who did not seem to share Aspytis' good humor.
"I think I even have some clothes on board that will fit you, lady. They should suit your beauty better than your traveling clothes."
"How nice," Miriamel said, then remembered her imposture.
"If it meets with Brother Cadrach's approval."
"You have women's clothes on board?"
Cadrach asked, eyebrow raised.
"Left by my sister."
Aspytis' smile was untroubled.
"Your sister," he grunted. "Yes, well, I shall have to think on it."
Miriamel started to raise her voice to the monk, then remembered her situation. She strove to look obedient, but silently cursed him. Why shouldn't she be allowed to wear nice clothes for a change? As the Earl began to talk animatedly of his family's great keep, beside Lake Aedhne, ironically a freehold that Miriamel had visited when a very young child, although she did not now remember it. There was a rap at the door. One of Aspytis' pages went to answer it.
"I come to speak with the ship's lord,"
a breathy voice said.
"Come in, my friend," Aspytis said. "We have all met, of course. Ganite, you're the one who found Lady Maria and her guardian, yes?"
"That is true, Earl Aspytis,"
the Niski nodded. Her black eyes twinkled as they reflected the lamplight.
"If you would be so good as to come back in a while,"
Aspytis said to the Sea Watcher, "then we will talk."
"No, please, Earl Aspytis," Miriamel stood. "You've been very kind, but we should not keep you any longer. Come, Brother Cadrach."
"Keep me?"
Aspytis put a hand to his breast.
"Should I complain at being the victim of such lovely company? Lady Maria, you must think me a dullard indeed."
He bowed and took her hand, holding it for a lingering moment against his lips.
I hope you do not think me too forward, sweet lady.
He snapped his fingers for a page.
Young Thoris will show you to your beds. I have put the captain out of his cabin. You will sleep there.
Oh, but we couldn't take the captain's.
He spoke out of turn and did not show you proper respect, Lady Maria. He is lucky I do not hang him. But I am willing to forgive. He is a simple man, not used to women on his ships. A few nights sleeping at general quarters with his crew will do him no harm.
He dragged fingers through his curly hair, then waved his hand.
Go on, Thoris, lead them.
He bowed to Miriamel again, then smiled politely at Cadrach. This time Cadrach returned the smile, but it seemed little more than a baring of teeth. The little page, lantern held carefully before him, led his charges out the door. Aspites stood silent a while in thought, then found the wine ewer and poured himself another goblet full, which he drank off in a long swallow. At last he spoke.
So, Ganite, it is unusual for you to come here, and it is even more unusual for you to leave the bow at night. Are the waters so untroubled that your song is not needed?
The Niski shook her head slowly.
No, ship's master, the waters are very troubled, but for this moment they are safe, and I wish to come and tell you that I am disturbed.
Disturbed? By the girl? Surely Niskis are not superstitious like sailors.
Not like sailors, no.
She pulled her hood forward, hiding all but her bright eyes.
The girl and the monk, even if they are not what they say, are the least of my worries. There is a great storm coming down from the north.
Aspites looked up at Ganite.
You left the bow to tell me that? He asked mockingly. I have known that since before we set sail.
The captain says we will be out of deep waters before the storm reaches us.
That may be, but there are great shoals of kilpa moving in from the northern seas, as if they are swimming before the storm. Their song is fierce and cold, El Aspites. They seem to come up from the blackest water, from the deepest trenches. I have never heard the like.
Aspites stared for a moment, his whole aspect slightly out of kilter, as though the wine had finally begun to affect him.
Aidan the Cloud has many important tasks to perform for Duke Benigaris, he said. You must do what it is your life's work to do.
He lowered his head into the palms of his hands.
I am tired, Ganite. Go back to the bow. I need to sleep.
The Niski watched him for a moment, full of imponderable gravity, then bowed gracefully and backed out of the door, letting it fall shut behind her with a quiet thump. Aspites leaned forward across the table, pillowing his head on his forearms in the circle of lamplight.
It is good to be around a nobleman once more, Miriamel said. They are full of themselves, yes, but they do understand how to show a woman respect.
Cadrach snorted from his pallet on the floor.
I find it hard to believe you could see any value in that ringleted fop, princess.
Hush, Miriamel hissed. Idiot, don't speak so loudly, and don't call me that. I'm Lady Maria, remember?
The monk made another noise of disgust.
A noblewoman chased by fire dancers. That was a pretty tale to spin.
It worked, didn't it?
Yes. And now we must spend our time with Earl Aspites, who will ask question after question. If you had only said you were a poor tailor's daughter who had hidden in fear for her virtue, or some such, the Earl would leave us alone and put us off at the first island where they take on water and provisions.
and make us work like dogs until then, if he didn't just throw us into the sea. I, for one, am growing tired of this disguise. It is bad enough I have been an acolyte monk all this time. Now should I be a tailor's daughter as well?
Although she could not see him in the darkened cabin, Miriamel knew by the sound of his voice that Kadrach was shaking his heavy head in disagreement.
No, 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 do you understand nothing, lady? We are not choosing parts like a children's game. We are struggling to stay alive. Dinevan, the man who brought us here, has been killed. Do you understand? Your father and your uncle are at war. The war is spreading. They have killed the Lector, the Ransomer's chief priest on the face of Austin Ard, and they will stop at nothing, lady. It is no game.
Miriamel choked back an angry reply, thinking instead about what Kadrach had said.
Then why didn't Earl Aspytus say anything about the Lector? Surely it's the kind of thing people would talk about.
Or did you make that up as well? Lady, Renesin was only killed late last night. We left early in the morning.
The monk struggled to keep his patience. The Sankelen Adonitis and the Escritorial Council may not announce what has happened for a day or two.
Please believe what I say is true, or we will both come to a terrible end.
Miriamel lay back, pulling the blanket up to her chin. The feeling of the boat rocking was quite soothing.
It seems that if it weren't for my inventiveness and the Earl's good manners, we might have come to a terrible end already.
Think what you like, lady,
Kadrach said heavily.
But do not, I beg you, extend your trust to others any farther than you have with me.
He fell silent. Miriamel waited for sleep. An odd, hauntingly alien melody floated on the air, timeless and arrhythmic as the roar of the sea, persistent as the rising and falling wind. Somewhere in the darkness outside, Ganitte was singing the Kilpa down. Eilir rode down out of the heights of the Grianspog Mountains in the midst of the summer's worst snowstorm. The secret trails that he and his men had so laboriously cut through the forest only weeks before were now buried beneath 3 cubits of drifting white. The dismal skies hung oppressively close, like the ceiling of a tomb. His saddlebags were crammed with carefully drawn maps, his head with brooding thoughts. Eilir knew there was no use pretending that the land was suffering only a long bout of freakish weather. A grievous sickness was spreading over Austin Ard. Perhaps Joshua and his father's sword truly were tied up in something vaster than the wars of men. The Count of Nad Mullach was suddenly reminded of his own words, uttered over the king's great table a year before. Gods of earth and sky, he thought, but didn't it seem a lifetime since those relatively peaceful days?
Evil is abroad, he had told the assembled knights that day.
It is not only bandits who prey on travelers and cause the disappearance of isolated farmers. The people of the north are afraid.
Not only bandits. Eilir shook his head, disgusted with himself. He had been so caught up in the day-to-day matters of his people's struggle to survive that he had failed to heed his own warning. There were indeed greater menaces to fear than Skali of Coldskraker and his cutthroat army. Eilir had heard stories told by survivors of the fall of Neglamund, the bewildered accounts of a ghostly army raised by Elias the High King. From the days of his childhood, Eilir had heard tales of the White Foxes, demons who lived in the blackest, coldest lands of the uttermost north, who appeared like a plague, then vanished again. All during this last year, the Frostmarch dwellers had whispered over their night fires of just such pale demons. How foolish that Eilir, of all people, should not have realized the truth behind these tales. Had he not spoken of just that at the great table? But what could it all mean? If they were truly involved, why should creatures like these white foxes side with Elias? Could it have something to do with that monstrous priest, Priorates? The Count of Nad Mullach sighed, then leaned far to the side to help his horse balance as they made their way down a treacherous hill path. Perhaps, for all her foolishness, Maegwin had been right to set this task for him. But still, that was no justification for the way in which she had done it. Why should she treat him as she did in the underground city, after all he had done for her family, and the faithful service he had given her father, King Luth? The terror and strangeness of their situation might be the reason for such unkindness, but it was no excuse. Such thoughtlessness was yet another odd change in Maegwin's demeanor, the latest of many. He feared for her deeply, but could think of no way to help. She despised his solicitousness, and seemed to think he was little more than a sly courtier. Eolair, who hated falsity, yet had been driven to master it in the loyal service of her father. When he tried to help, she insulted him and turned her back. He could only watch her sickening as the land around him had sickened, her mind filling with strange fancies. He could do nothing. Eolair was 2 days making his way down through the silent valleys of the Grianspog, with only his own cold thoughts for company. It was astonishing to see how quickly Skali was making his occupation of Hernesteia permanent. Not content with taking over those houses and buildings still standing in Hernisadark and the surrounding villages, the Thane of Cold Skriker had begun to construct new ones, great longhouses of rough-hewn timbers. The Kirkoil forest fringe was shrinking rapidly, replaced by a growing expanse of mutilated tree stumps. Eolair made his way along the ridge tops, watching the ant-like figures swarming over the flatlands below. The clatter of hammer on wedge rang through the snowy hills. He could not at first understand why Skali should need to build more dwelling places. The conqueror's army, while of good size, was hardly so vast that it could not harbour itself in the Hernesteria's abandoned dwellings. It was only when Eolair looked away to the lowering northern skies that he realized what was happening. All Skali's Rimmer's folk must be coming here from the north, old and young, women and children. He stared down at the tiny industrious shapes. If it's snowing in Hernisadark in late Tiagar month, it must be a frozen hell up by Narved and Skogi. Bagba, bite me, what a thought. Skali has chased us into the caves. Now he will move his Rimmer's Guarders onto our captured lands. Despite all that his folk had already suffered at the hands of Skali's sharp-noses warriors, despite King Luth struck down, Prince Gwythyn tortured and dismembered, and hundreds of Eolair's own brave Mullachy dead beneath the grey skies of the western meadows, the Count found suddenly, and to his surprise, that he contained depths of anger and raw hatred yet unplumbed. Skali's men strutting in the roads of Hernisadark was bad enough, but the thought of them bringing their women and families to live on Hernesteri land filled Eolair with an unchanneled rage, stronger than he had felt since the first Hernesteermen had fallen at the Innisgrich. Helpless on the ridgetop, he cursed the invaders, and promised himself that he would see Skali's jackals whipped howling back to Cold Skriker, those who did not die on the precious Hernesteri soil that they had usurped. Suddenly, the Count of Nad Mullach longed for the purity of battle. The Hernesteri forces had been so savaged at Innisgrich that they had been unable to fight anything but rearguard actions since. Now they had been driven into hiding in the Grianspog, and there was little they could do but harass the victors. Gods, he thought, but it would be fine to swing steel in the open once more, to line up breast to breast with shields flashing sunlight and sound the charge. The Count knew it was a foolish craving, knew himself for a careful man who always preferred talking sensibly to fighting. But just now he craved simplicity. Open warfare, for all its witless violence and horror, could seem a sort of beautiful idiocy into which one could throw oneself as into the arms of a lover. Now the call of that compelling but dangerous lover was growing stronger. whole nations seemingly on the march, topsy-turvy weather, madmen ruling and dire legends come to life. How he suddenly longed for simple things. But even as he yearned for unthinking release, Aelair knew that he would hate its coming to be. The fruits of violence did not necessarily go to the just or the wise. Aelair skirted Hanisadark's westernmost outposts and circled far around the largest encampments of Skali's Rimmersmen, who would spread across the meadowlands beneath Hernesteir's capital. He rode instead through the hilly country called the Delathi, which stood like a bulwark along Hernesteir's coast, as if to prevent invasion by sea. Indeed, the Delathi would have presented a nearly impossible problem for any would-be conqueror, but the invasion which had undone Hernesteir had come from the opposite direction. The Highland folk were a suspicious lot, but they had grown used to war fugitives in the past year, so Aelair was able to find welcome in a few houses. Those who took him in were far more interested in his news than the fact that their guest was the Count of Nad Mullach. These were days when gossip was the most valued coin in the country. So far from the cities, no one had known much of Prince Josue in the first place, let alone how his struggle with the High King might be somehow connected to Hernesteir's plight. No one in the Delathi country had the slightest idea of whether King Elias' brother Josue was alive or dead, let alone where he might be. But the Highlanders had heard of their own King Luth's mortal wounding from the tales of wandering soldiers, survivors of the fighting at the Inniscrick. Thus, Aelair's hosts were usually heartened to discover from him that Luth's daughter still lived, and that a Hernesteiri caught in exile of sorts still existed. Before the war, they had thought little of what the king in the Teig said or did, but he had been part of their lives nonetheless. Aelair guessed they found it reassuring that at least a shadow of the old kingdom remained, as though the continued existence of Luth's family somehow assured that the Rimmersmen would eventually be forced out. Coming down out of the Delathi, Aelair steered wide of high-walled Cranhir, Hernesteir's strangest and most insular city, guiding his horse instead toward Abengeet at the mouth of the River Beralian. He was unsurprised to find that the Hernesteirmen of Abengeet had found a way to live under the heavy hands of both Elias and Skali. Abengeeters had a reputation for flexibility. It was a common joke in other parts of the country to refer to the port city as extremely north Perdruin, because of the shared affection for profits and dislike of politics, the kind of politics that interfered with business anyway. It was also in Abengeet that Aelair received his first real clue to Josua's whereabouts, and it happened in a very typical Abengeet way. Aelair shared a supper table with an Abene priest in an inn along the waterfront. The wind was howling and rain was beating on the roof, making the common room rumble like a drum. Under the very eyes of bearded Rimmersmen and haughty Erkinlanders, Hernesteir's new conquerors, the good father, who had perhaps had one tankard of ale too many, told Aelair a disjointed but fascinating story. He had just arrived from the Sankelen Adonitis in Naban, and he swore that he had been told by someone there, someone he characterized as the most important priest in the Sankelen, that Josue Lackhand had survived Naglamund. The prince, with seven other survivors, had made his way eastward through the grasslands to safety. These facts had been told to him, the priest said, only under the condition of his complete discretion. Immediately after telling this tale, Aelair's companion, full of drunken remorse, begged him swear to secrecy. As the count felt sure, the priest had begged many other recipients of this same secret. Aelair agreed, with a commendably straight face. There were several things that interested Aelair about this tale. The exact number of survivors in Josua's party seemed a possible indication of its authenticity. Although he had to admit it sounded almost like a legend in the making. The one-handed prince and his gallant seven. Also, the priest's contrition about blurting out the secret seemed genuine. He had not told the tale to make himself appear more grand. Rather, he was simply the kind of man who could not keep a confidence to save his soul. This, of course, raised a question. Why would a man of some importance to Mother Church, as the priest's informant supposedly was, entrust such a vital piece of intelligence to a numwit, on whose flushed, foolish face untrustworthiness was clearly written? Surely no one could expect this cheerful drunkard to keep anything to himself, let alone keep hidden a subject of such interest in the war-torn north. Aelair was puzzled, but intrigued. As thunder growled over the frost march, the Count of Nad Mullach began to consider a journey to the grassy country beyond Erkenland. Later that night, coming back from the stables, Aelair never trusted others to take proper care of his horse, a habit that had benefited him more often than not. He stopped outside the inn's front door. A fierce wind, laden with snow, blew down the street, banging the shuttered windows. Beyond the docks, the sea murmured uneasily. All of Avangeet's inhabitants seemed to have vanished. The midnight city was a ghost ship, floating captainless beneath the moon. Strange lights played across the northern sky, yellow and indigo, and a violet like the afterimage of lightning. The horizon pulsed with rippling, radiant bands, unlike anything Aelair had ever seen, at once chilling and yet incredibly vital. Compared to silent Abengeet, the north seemed wildly alive, and for a mad moment the Count wondered if it was worth fighting anymore. The world he had known was gone, and nothing could bring it back. Perhaps it would be better just to accept. He smacked his gloved hands together. The clap echoed dully and faded. He shook his head, trying to shake the leadenness from his thoughts. The lights were compelling indeed. And where would he go now? It was a ride of several weeks to the meadowlands beyond Hasu Vale, of which the priest had spoken. Aelair knew he could cling to the coastline, passing Merrimond and Wentmouth, but that would mean riding as a lone traveller through an Erkenland that owed its complete allegiance to the High King. Or he could let the shimmering aurora draw him north instead, to his home in Nad Mullach. His keep was occupied by Skali's reavers, but those of his people who survived in the countryside would give him shelter and news, and also a chance to rest and reprovision himself for the remainder of his long journey. From there, he could turn east and pass Urchester to the north, moving in the protective shadow of the great forest. Pondering, he stared at the spectral glow in the northern sky. It made for a very chilly light. The waves were choppy, the dark sky wild with tattered, ominous clouds. A zigzag of lightning flared on the blackened horizon. Cadrach gripped the railing and groaned as the Aedhna cloud lifted high, then settled once more into the trough of a wave. Overhead the sails popped in the strong wind, percussive bursts of sound like whip cracks.
"Oh, Brynjok of the skies," the monk implored, "take this tempest away."
"This is barely a storm at all," Miriamel said derisively. "You've never been in a real sea storm." Cadrach made a gulping sound.
"Nor do I want to be."
"Besides, what are you doing, praying to pagan gods? I thought you were an Aedhnite monk."
"I have been praying for Usiri's intercession all afternoon," Cadrach said, his face pale as fish flesh. "I thought it time to try something different."
He rose on tiptoes and leaned farther out over the railing. Miriamel turned her head away. A moment later the monk settled back, wiping his mouth with his sleeve. A spatter of rain drifted across the deck.
"And you, lady," he said, "does nothing bother you?"
She bit back a mocking reply. He looked truly pathetic, his few strands of hair pasted flat. his eyes dark-rimmed.
Many things, but not being on a boat at sea.
Count yourself blessed, he mumbled, then turned back to sag against the rail once more. Instead, his eyes widened. He screeched in shock and tumbled backward, falling rump-first to the deck.
Bones of a Naxos, he shouted. Save us! What is it?
Miriamel stepped to the rail to see a grey head bobbing in the saddle of the waves. It was vaguely manlike, hairless yet unscaled, sleek as a dolphin, with a red-rimmed, toothless mouth and eyes like rotting blackberries. The flexible mouth rounded into a circle, as though it would sing. It gave out a strange gurgling hoot, then slipped beneath the waves, showing a glimpse of long-toed, webbed feet as it dove. A moment later, the nub of head appeared again a little closer to the ship. It watched them. Miriamel's stomach fluttered.
Kilpa, she whispered.
It is horrible, Cadrach said, still crouching below the whale. It has the face of a damned soul.
The empty black eyes followed Miriamel as she moved a few steps up the railing. She understood the monk clearly. The Kilpa was far more horrifying than any mere animal could be, no matter how savage. So dreadfully near human, yet so devoid of anything that looked like human feeling or understanding.
I have not seen one in years, she said slowly,
unable to tear her eyes away.
I don't think I have ever seen one so close.
Her thoughts tumbled back to her childhood, to a trip she had taken with her mother, Hylissa, from Naban to the island of Venita. Kilpa had glided in and out of their wake, and to the younger Miriamel they had seemed almost sportive, like porpoises or flying fish. Seeing this one so closely, she now understood why her mother had hastily dragged her from the rail. She shuddered.
You say that you have seen them before, my lady?
A voice asked. She whirled to find Aspytis standing behind her, his hand resting on crouching Cadrach's shoulder. The monk looked quite sick.
On a long-ago visit to Wentmouth, she said hastily. They are terrible, aren't they?
Aspytis nodded slowly, staring at Miriamel rather than the slick grey thing bobbing off the stern rail.
I hadn't realized that Kilpa traveled into cold northern waters, he said.
Doesn't Gan-Ite keep them away?
She said, trying to change the subject.
Why has this one come so close?
Because the Niski is exhausted and is sleeping for a while.
And also because the Kilpa have become very bored.
Aspytis bent and picked a square-headed iron nail off the deck, then pitched it at the silent watcher. It splashed a foot from the Kilpa's noseless, earless head. The black eyes did not blink.
They are more active than I have ever heard of these days, the Earl said. They have swarmed several small craft since the winter, and even a few large ones.
He hurriedly raised a hand on which gold rings sparkled.
But fear not, Lady Maria. There is no better singer than my Gan-Ite.
That thing is a horror, and I am ill,
Cadrach groaned.
I must go and lay myself down.
He ignored Aspytis' proffered hand and clambered to his feet, then went stumbling away. The Earl turned and shouted instructions to the crewmen swarming in the wind-buffeted rigging.
We must reef the sails, he said by way of explanation. There is a very fierce storm coming, and we can only ride it out.
As if to underscore his point, lightning flashed once more on the northern horizon.
Perhaps you would be good enough to join me for my evening meal.
Thunder came rolling across the swells. A flurry of rain swept over them.
That way, your guardian can be given some privacy to recuperate, and you need not be without company if the storm grows frightening.
He smiled, showing even teeth. Miriamel felt tempted, but cautious. There was an impression of coiled strength to Aspytis, as though some potential were being hidden, so as not to frighten. In a way, it reminded her of old Ducas Grimnor, who treated women with gentle, almost excessive deference, as though his blundering bluffness might at any time escape his control and burst forth to shock and offend. Aspytis, too, seemed to hold something in check. It was a quality she found intriguing.
"Thank you, your lordship," she said at last. "I would be honored. You will have to excuse me, though, if I must leave from time to time, to see that Brother Cadrach is not suffering too badly, for want of aid or company."
"Did you not," Aspytis said, smoothly taking her arm, "you would not be the good and gentle lady that you are. I can see that you two are as close as family, that you respect Cadrach as you would a beloved uncle."
Miriamel could not help looking over her shoulder as Aspytis led her across the deck, beneath the crewmen shouting at each other in the rigging so they could be heard above the wail of the wind. The kilper still floated in the rough green seas, watching solemnly as a priest, its open mouth a round black hole. The Earl's squire, a thin, whey-faced young man with a resentful frown, directed the two pages as they loaded the table with fruit and bread and white cheese. Thuris, the smaller of the pages, tottered out beneath the weight of a salver, bearing a cold joint of beef. The boy stayed to assist, handing the squire a new carving utensil each time that artist impatiently waved his hand. The little page seemed clever. His dark eyes watched the pasty-faced squire intently for the slightest sign. But the bad-tempered older boy nevertheless found several opportunities to cuff him for his slowness.
"You seem very comfortable on a ship, Lady Maria," Aspytis said, smiling as he filled a wine goblet from a beautiful brass ewer.
He had his other page carry it around the table to her.
"Have you been at sea before? It is a long way from Kelodshir to what we in Naban call the Vermenis, the Great Green."
Miriamel silently cursed herself. Perhaps Cadrach was right. She should have thought of a simpler story to tell.
"Yes. I mean, no, I haven't. Not really."
She took a long, studied sip of wine, forcing herself to smile back at the Earl despite its sourness.
"We traveled on shipboard down the Glenywent several times. I have been on the Kinsler as well."
She took another long sip and realized she had emptied the goblet. She set it down, embarrassed.
What would this man think of her? "Who is we?" "I beg your pardon?"
She guiltily pushed the goblet away. But Aspytis took this as a sign and refilled it, pushing it back to her side of the rimmed table with an understanding smile. As the cabin pitched with the boat's motion, the wine threatened to overtop the edge of the goblet. Miriamel picked it up, holding it very gingerly.
"I said, who is we, Lady Maria, if I may ask? You and your guardian, you and your family? You mentioned your father, Baron...
He frowned.
"A thousand apologies. I've forgotten his name."
Miriamel had forgotten also. She covered her moment of panic with another sip of wine. It became rather a long sip as she struggled with her memory. The name she had chosen came back at last. She swallowed.
"Baron Siomen." "Of course, Baron Siomen. Was that who took you down the Glenywent?"
She nodded her head, hoping not to get into any further trouble.
"And your mother?" "Dead."
"Ah." Aspytis' golden face became somber as a cloud-curtained sun.
"Forgive me. I am being rude. Asking so many questions. I am terribly sorry to hear that."
Miriamel had a moment of inspiration.
"She died in the plague last year."
The Earl nodded. "So many did.
Tell me, Lady Maria, if you will allow me one last and quite forward question, is there a special man to whom you are promised?"
"No," she answered quickly, then wondered if she could have given a better and less potentially troublesome answer. She took a deep breath, holding the Earl's gaze.
The pomander that scented the cabin air was rich in her nostrils.
No,
she repeated. He was very handsome.
Ah,
Aspites nodded gravely. With his youthful face and head of brilliant curls, he seemed almost a child, play-acting as an adult.
But see, you have not eaten anything, lady. Does the fare displease you?
Oh, no, Earl Aspites, she said breathlessly, looking for a spot to put her wine goblet down so she could pick up her knife. She noticed that the cup was empty. Aspites saw her look and leaned forward with the ewer. As she picked at her food, Aspites talked. As if in apology for his earlier interrogation, he kept his conversation airy as swan's down, speaking mostly of odd or silly things that happened at the Nabonae court. To hear him talk, it was quite a glittering place. He told stories well, and soon had her laughing. In fact, with the rocking of the ship and the walls of the small, lamp-lit cabin pressing in upon her, she began to wonder if she was laughing too much. The whole thing felt rather dreamlike. She was having difficulty keeping her eyes squarely on a spitey, smiling face. As she suddenly realized that she could no longer see the Earl at all, a hand came to rest lightly upon her shoulder. Aspites was behind her, still talking about the ladies of the court. Through the wine fumes that filled her head, she could feel his touch, weighty and hot. But of course their beauty is that rather arranged beauty, if you know what I mean, Maria. I do not mean to be cruel, but sometimes when Duchess Nesalanta is caught in a breeze, the powder flies off her like snow from a mountain top. Aspites' hand squeezed gently, then moved to her other shoulder as he altered his stance. On the way, his fingers trailed gently across the nape of her neck. She shuddered.
Do not misunderstand me, he said. I would defend to the death the honor and beauty of our courtly Nabonae women. But, in my heart, there is nothing so fine as the unimproved loveliness of a country girl.
His hand moved to her neck again, the touch delicate as a thrush's wing.
You are such a beauty, Lady Maria. I am so pleased to have met you. I had forgotten what it was to see a face that needed no embellishment.
The room spun. Miriamelle abruptly straightened and her elbow toppled the wine cup. A few drops like blood pooled on her hand towel.
I must go outside, she said. I must have some air.
My lady, Aspites said, concern plain in his voice. Are you ill?
I hope it is not my poor table that has offended your gentle constitution.
She waved a hand, trying to placate him, wanting only to be out of the glaring lamplight and the stiflingly warm, perfumed air.
No, no, I just want to go outside.
But there is a storm, my lady.
You would be soaked. I can't allow it.
She stumbled a few steps toward the door.
Please, I'm ill.
The Earl shrugged helplessly. Let me at least get you a warm cloak that will keep out most of the damp. He clapped for his pages, who were trapped with the unpleasant squire, in the tiny room that served as both larder and kitchen. One of the pages began to go through a large chest in search of an appropriate garment, while Miriamelle stood by miserably. She was at last outfitted in a musty-smelling wool cloak with a hood. Aspites, similarly dressed, took her elbow and guided her up onto the deck. The wind was blowing in earnest. Torrents of rain sliced down, turning to cascades of sparkling gold as they passed through the guttering lamplight, then vanishing back into blackness. Thunder drummed.
Let us at least sit beneath the canopy, Lady Maria,
Aspites cried, or we will both of us catch some terrible ague. He led her aft, where a red-striped sailcloth awning stretched between the whales, humming as it vibrated in the strong wind. A steersman, in a flapping cloak, bowed his head as they ducked beneath the cloth, but kept his hands firmly clasped on the tiller. The pair sat down on a pile of dampened rugs.
Thank you, Miriamelle said. You are kind. I feel very foolish to trouble you.
I only worry that this is a cure, worse than the illness, Aspites said, smiling. If my physician were to hear of this, he would be leeching me for brain fever before I could blink.
Miriamel laughed and shivered in quick succession. Despite the chill, the tangy sea air had vastly improved her outlook. She no longer felt as though she might faint. In fact, she felt so much better that she did not object when the Earl of Aetna and Drina slipped a solicitous arm around her shoulders.
You are a strange, but fascinating young woman, Lady Maria,
Aspites whispered, barely audible above the moan of the wind. His breath was warm against the chilled flesh of her ear.
I feel there is some mystery about you. Are all country girls so full of moods?
Miriamel was very definitely of two minds about the tingling that was running right through her. Fear and excitement seemed dangerously intermixed.
Don't, she said at last.
Don't what, Maria?
Even as the storm roared and flailed outside, Aspites' touch was solemn, silken. A flurry of confusing images seemed to sweep in on the wind. Her father's cold, distant face. Young Simon, crookedly smiling. The riverbanks of the Aelfwent flashing past, flickering with light and shadow. Her blood was warm and loud in her ears.
No,
she said, pulling free of the Earl's clinging arm. She scrambled forward until she was out from under the canopy and could straighten up. The rain smacked wetly against her face.
But Maria! Thank you for the lovely supper, Earl Aspites. I have been a great deal of trouble, and I beg your forgiveness.
No forgiveness need be sought, my lady.
Then I will bid you good night.
She stood, buffeted by the strong wind, and made her way unsteadily down to the deck, then followed the cabin wall to the ladder down into the narrow corridor. She stepped through the door into the cabin she shared with Cadrach. She stood in darkness and listened to the monk's even, sonorous breathing, thankful that he did not wake. A few moments later came the sound of Aspites' boots on the ladder rungs. His cabin door opened, then closed behind him. For a long while, Miriamel leaned against the door. Her heart beat as swiftly as if she had been hiding for her life's preservation.
Was this love? Fear?
What kind of spell did the golden-haired Earl cast, that she should feel so wild, so pursued? She was breathless and confused as a flushed hare. The thought of lying on her bed, trying to sleep while her thoughts raced, and Cadrach snored on the floor, was intolerable. She opened the cabin door a crack and listened, then slipped out into the corridor and onto the deck once more. Despite the rain pelting down, the storm seemed to have lessened. The deck still pitched so that she could not make her way forward without keeping a hand on the shrouds, but the sea had calmed considerably. A trill of disquieting but curiously seductive melody drew her along. The song curved and recurved, stitching the stormy night like a thread of silver green. By turns it was soft or hearty or piercingly loud. But the changes unfolded so joinlessly that it was impossible to remember what had been happening a moment before, or to understand how anything different than what was happening at this particular moment could even exist. Ganite sat cross-legged in the forecastle, head thrown back so that her hood fell loosely on her shoulders, and her white hair streamed in the breeze. Her eyes were closed. She swayed from side to side, as though her song were a fast-moving river which took every bit of her concentration to ride. Miriamel drew her own hooded cloak close and settled into the dubious shelter of the ship's wail to listen. The Niski's song went on for what seemed an hour, sliding smoothly from pitch to pitch and pace to pace. Sometimes her liquid words seemed arrows that flew outward to spark and sting. Other times an array of gems that dazzled with smoldering colors. Through it all ran a deeper melody that never entirely disappeared, a melody which seemed to speak of peaceful green depths, of sleep, and of the coming of a heavy, comfortable silence. Miriamel awakened with a little start. When she lifted her head, it was to see Gan Itte regarding her curiously from the forecastle. Now that the Niski had stopped singing, the roar of the ocean seemed curiously flat and tuneless.
"What are you doing, child?"
Miriamel was oddly embarrassed. She had never been so near a singing Niski before. It almost seemed that she had been spying on some very private thing.
"I came out on deck to get some air. I was having supper with Earl Aspites and felt sick."
She took a breath to still her shaking voice.
"You sing wonderfully."
Gan Itte smiled slyly.
"That is true. Or the Aetna cloud would not have made so many safe voyages. Come, sit by me and talk. I need not sing for a while, and the late watches are lonely."
Miriamel climbed up, seating herself beside the Niski.
"Do you get tired singing?" she asked.
Gan Itte laughed quietly.
"Does a mother grow tired raising her children? Of course, but it is what I do."
Miriamel stole a glance at Gan Itte's wrinkled face. The Niski's eyes peered out from beneath her white brows, fixed on the spray and swells.
"Why did Cadrach call you Tinuk?"
She tried to remember the word.
"Tenukedea. Because that is what we are. Ocean children. Your guardian is learned."
"But what does it mean?"
"It means we always lived on the ocean. Even in the faraway garden, we dwelt always at land's end. It has only been since we came to this place that some of the navigator's children have been changed. Some have left the sea entirely, which is as hard for me to understand as if someone were to stop breathing and claim that was a good way to live."
She shook her head, pursing her thin lips.
"Where are your people from?"
"Far away. Austin Ard is only our most recent home."
Miriamel sat for a while, thinking.
"I always thought that Niskis were just like Rannaman. You look very much like Rannaman."
Gan Itte laughed sibilantly.
"I have heard," she said, "that though they are different, some animals grow to look like each other because they do the same things. Perhaps the Rannaman, like the Tenokedea, have bowed their heads for too long."
She laughed again, but Miriamel did not think it was a happy laugh.
"And you, child,"
the Niski said at last,
"it is your turn to answer questions. Why are you here?"
Miriamel stared, caught off balance.
"What?
Why are you here? I have thought about what you said, and I am not sure I believe you."
"Earl Aspites does," Miriamel said a little defiantly.
"That may be true, but I am altogether different."
Gan Itte turned her gaze on Miriamel. Even in the dim lamplight, the Niski's eyes glittered like anthracite.
"Speak to me."
Miriamel shook her head and tried to pull away, but a thin, strong hand closed on her arm.
"I am sorry," Gan Itte said. "I have frightened you. Let me put your mind at ease. I have decided that there is no harm in you, no harm to the Aetna cloud, at least, which is what I care about. I am considered peculiar among my folk, because I judge quickly. When I like something or someone, I like it."
She chuckled dryly.
I have decided that I like you, Maria. If that is your name. It shall be your name for now, if you wish. You need never fear me. Not old Gan-Ite.
Bewildered by the night, by wine, and by this latest of many unusual feelings, Miriamel began to weep.
Now, child, now!
Ganite's gentle, spidery hand patted her back.
I have no home.
Miriamel fought her tears. She felt herself on the verge of saying things she should not say, no matter how much she wished to be unburdened.
I am a fugitive.
Who pursues you?
Miriamel shook her head. Spray arched high over the bow as the ship nosed down into another trough.
I cannot say, but I am in terrible danger. That's why I had to hide on the boat.
And the monk, your learned guardian, is he not in danger, too?
Miriamel was brought up short by Gan-Ite's question. There was much she had not had time to think about.
Yes, I suppose he is.
The Niski nodded, as if satisfied.
Fear not. Your secret is safe with me.
You won't tell Aspitus, the Earl?
Ganite shook her head.
My own allegiances are more complex than you can know, but I cannot promise you he will remain ignorant. He is a clever one, Aid Nacloud's master.
I know.
Miriamel's reply was heartfelt. The mounting storm flung down another wash of rain. Gan-Ite leaned forward, staring out into the wind-tossed sea.
House of Vey, they do not stay down long. Curse them. But they are strong.
She turned to Miriamel.
I think it is time for me to sing once more. It would probably be good for you to get below deck.
Miriamel awkwardly thanked the Niski for her companionship, then stood and made her way down the slippery ladder and off the forecastle. Thunder growled like a beast hunting them through the darkness. She wondered suddenly, desperately, if she had been a fool to open her heart to this strange creature. At the hatchway, she stopped, cocking her head. In the black night behind her, Ganite's song had been lifted against the storm once more, a slender ribbon offered to hold back the angry sea. Chapter 24. Dogs of Urchester. Joshua's company rode north along the banks of the River Stefflod, heading upstream from the juncture with the Instrecker, through grassland rumpled with low hills. Soon the downs began to rise higher on either side, so that the prince's folk found themselves travelling through a meadowed river valley, a wide trough of land with the watercourse at its centre. The Stefflod wound along beneath the sombre sky, shining dully as a vein of tarnished silver. Like the Imstrecker, its song at first seemed muffled, but Deornoth thought this river had a queer undertone to its murmuring, as though it hid the voices of a great whispering throng. Sometimes the noise of the water seemed to rise in what was almost a thread of melody, clear as a succession of pealing bells. A moment later, as Deornoth strained to hear what it was that had captured his attention, nothing sounded but the mutter and rush of moving water. The light playing upon the Stefflod's surface was just as dreamily inconstant. Despite the overcast, the water glimmered at times as though cold-burning stars were rolling and bumping along the river's bottom. At other moments, the gleam heightened to a sparkle like a froth of jewels. Then, just as suddenly, whether the sun was showing or cloud-hidden, The waterway would again become dark and unreflective as lead.
Strange, isn't it?
Father Strangyard said. For all the things we've seen, my goodness, the world still has more to show us, doesn't it?
There's something very alive about it.
Deonoth squinted. A curl of light seemed to wriggle on the river's agitated skin, like a radiant fish struggling against the current.
Well, it is all, all part of God,
Strangyard said, making the sign of the tree on his breast.
So of course it is alive.
He squinted too, frowning slightly.
But I do know what you mean, said Deonoth.
The valley that had gradually risen around them seemed to take much of its character from the river. Willow trees stood sleepily beside the watercourse, shivering as they bent to the cold water, like women washing their hair. As the riders travelled farther, the river widened and slowed. Thickets of reeds appeared along the banks, resplendent with birds who shrieked from their bowers to warn all their tribe that strangers walked the land.
Strangers,
Deonoth thought.
That is what we suddenly seem here, as if we have passed out of the lands meant for our folk and crossed over into someone else's domain.
He remembered Jaloi's words on that night, weeks back, when they had first met her in the forest.
Sometimes you men are like lizards, sunning on the stones of a crumbled house, thinking, what a nice basking spot someone built for me.
The witch woman had frowned as she spoke.
She told us we were in Scythian lands, he recalled.
Now we are again entering their fields. That is all. That is why things seem so strange.
Somehow this did not dispel his unsettled feeling. They made camp in a meadow. The low grass was dotted here and there with fairy rings, as the woman Ielda had called them, perfect circles of small white toadstools that shone faintly against the dark turf as twilight came on. Duchess Guttrun did not like the idea of sleeping so near to these rings, but Father Strangyard sensibly pointed out that the people of Gadrinset said the whole of this land belonged to the fairies, so the proximity of a mushroom ring meant little. Guttrun, more concerned for the safety of the child Leleth than herself, gave in with reservations. A small fire, made with willow branches they had gathered during the journey, helped to dispel some of the strangeness. The prince's party ate and talked quietly long into the evening. Old Towser, who had been sleeping so long and so deeply during the journey, that he hardly seemed one of their company any more, but more like a piece of baggage, awakened and lay staring at the night sky.
The stars aren't right, he said at last, so quietly that none heard him.
He repeated himself more loudly. Joshua came to kneel beside him, taking the jester's trembling hand in his.
What is it, Towser?
The stars, they aren't right.
The old man pulled his fingers free from the prince's grip and gestured upward.
There's the lamp, but it's got one star more than it should. And where's the crook? It shouldn't be gone till harvest time. And there's others there I don't know at all.
His lip quivered.
We're all dead. We've gone through into the shadow land, like my grandmother used to tell of. We're dead. Come now,
Joshua said gently. We are not dead. We are simply in a different place. And you have been in and out of dreams. Towser fixed him with a surprisingly sharp eye.
It is Anatol month, is it not? Don't think I am crazy old yet, no matter what I have been through. I have stared at summer skies for nearly twice your lifetime, young prince. We may be in a different place, but all Ostenard shares the same stars. Does it not?
Joshua was silent for a while. A thin babble of voices rose from the campfire behind him.
I did not mean to say you had lost your wits, old friend. We are in a strange place, and who knows what stars may shine upon us. In any case, there is nothing to be done about it.
He took the old man's hand again.
Why do you not come and sit closer to the fire? I think it would be comforting to have us all together, at least for a little while.
Towser nodded, and let Joshua help him rise.
A little warmth would not go amiss, my prince. I feel a growing cold in my bones, and I don't like it.
All the better, then, to sit near the fire on a damp night.
He led the old jester back. The fire had dimmed to embers, and Towser's unfamiliar stars were wheeling in the sky overhead. Joshua looked up when a hand touched his shoulder. Vosheva had a blanket draped over her arm.
Come, Joshua, she said. Let us go and make our bed by the riverside.
He looked around at the others, all sleeping but Dionoth and Strangyard, who talked quietly on the far side of the fire.
I do not think I should leave my people alone.
Leave your people? She said.
There was an edge of anger in her voice, but a moment later it gave way to a quiet laugh. She shook her head and her black hair fell across her face.
You will never change. I am your wife now. Do you remember that? We have gone 4 nights, as if our marriage had never happened, because you feared pursuit by the king's soldiers and wished to be close to the others. Do you still fear?
He looked up at her, his lip curled in a smile. Not tonight. He rose and put his arm about her slender waist, feeling the strong muscles of her back. Let us go down by the river. Joshua left his boots by the fire circle, and together they went barefoot through the damp grass, until the glow of the coals had disappeared behind them. The murmur of the river grew louder as they made their way down to the sandy verge. Vosheva unfurled the blanket and sank down upon it. Joshua joined her, pulling his heavy cloak over them both. For a while they lay in silence beside the dark Steflod, watching the moon holding court.